Yo Rocco, the podcast.
I always felt like I was half-assing it somewhere. You know, there was always some ball I was dropping at some time.
Hey, this is Rocky. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast. Thanks for listening. My guest this week is Carol Howard Merritt. Carol Howard Merritt is an author and a pastor and a speaker. She's written The Tribal Church. She's written Reframing Hope. And she's working on a third book right now that we talked about a little bit today. But most of the conversation with Carol today is about UNCO, the UNCONference that she's been a part of for about 5 years. They meet next week. It's a small gathering of people, a lot of pastors, a lot of other types of people from churches who get together. It's a relatively small group. And they plan and strategize for the church of the future that they want to see and that they want to create. So it was a really interesting conversation with Carol about that work and what she's looking forward to next week. So I really like listening to Carol speak. I like the stuff that she writes. I think that you're going to enjoy this conversation. So here's Carol. Thanks for listening. Thanks for talking to me. I really appreciate it. It was sort of short notice last week, and I know you have a big event coming up next week.
Yes.
It means a lot that you took time this week to talk to me about UNCO.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of it.
Yeah. So UNCO is next Monday is when it starts, right?
Right. It's next Monday. We're meeting in Stony Point, New York at the beautiful Stony Point Retreat Center. We also have one coming up in the fall in San Francisco. So, but we're all about East right now.
Okay. And are you all ready?
I think so. I mean, the beauty of this UNCONference, UNCO is short for UNCONference, and the beauty of it is that the participants bring the conference. So participants come together, we brainstorm different things, we talk about what we want to talk about. And then on the third day, we actually think about what projects have legs. In other words, what projects we want to move forward with. And so there's not a lot of like speakers that we have to figure out how to get their hotel rooms and their green M&Ms and all of that. You know, we don't have to deal with a lot of speakers, which there are good sides about that and downsides about that, but it's always really kind of a wonderful, wonderful, magical event. And I don't know how such amazing people always show up, but they do.
Yeah, I saw you you tweeted a couple things last week about this that were interesting. One was you said something to the effect of, you know, every freaking year it's like magic.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, you've been to events, I've been to events where you go and there are just people you can't stand there and you just kind of try to move away. And I'm not saying like everyone's roses or whatever. I'm sure I get on people's nerves. But at the same time, it's really incredibly creative people who are doing interesting ministry. It's a wonderful cross-section of people who are working with the homeless, working with intentional communities, working with garden churches, working with, you know, all sorts of different innovative, creative spaces. And yeah. So it's wonderful to get them all together.
Yeah, so the magic really for you consists in the fact that there's all these people doing so many different kinds of things, but they're all participating in the same thing at UNCO.
Right. So it's not the sort of place where you'll go and hear lectures. You won't go and hear lecture after lecture after lecture. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I make my living doing that. So every once in a while, my husband will get, because he helped to start UNCO, and he'll get on about, you know, these terrible conferences where everybody just speaks and lectures. And I'm like, wait, that's what I make my living doing. So I don't have any problem with that, but it's just a different sort of orientation. It's more of a community of people who are working and struggling together, and you're able to talk about your failures and your foibles and your, you know, what works and what's doing well. And so it's very much a different sort of atmosphere to it all.
Because with a speaker, I mean, when you invite big name speakers, you hope that's part of the draw, but also there that takes away as much as it gives, doesn't it?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I mean, it depends on, you know, what the participant needs. If the participant needs just to learn from something, I mean, as a speaker, I've been criticized a lot because they're like, you know, I really didn't want to hear what that pastor had to say. I have to, like, hear him go on and on after every single clergy gathering. You know, I wanted to hear what you had to say. So that's sort of, that's a common critique I'll get, because I often open the floor of the meeting for too long, or, you know, for some people. And so that'll be a common critique I'll get. So that's telling me that person came because I've been studying something for 10 years and they wanted to hear what I found out. But usually people who are going to UNCO want to be part of the struggle. They want to be learning things and sharing things and creating things together. So it's a different sort of learning environment, much more hands-on.
Yeah, I was really interested to read about on the website about the big board that you guys use to create the agenda for the gathering at the beginning, where everybody who has come with an idea or something they want to discuss can put that on the board and convene a session around it. That sounds really cool, but it also sounds really chaotic to me. Is it?
You know, it's a controlled chaos in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm the person who kind of keeps everybody almost on time, and but it's amazing how well it works. So basically, people will come and they want to talk about, and it ranges from, you know, Star Wars and church to
that would be Eric Clark.
Right. To starting a new publishing company to, you know, I mean, it'll range from, like, I can't get a day off ever, to, you know, all these sorts of things will come up on the board. And some of them are little daily gripes of, you know, being part of a traditional church, and others are big dreams and visions and goals people have. But we're all invited just to put this on the board. And it takes a while to percolate. I mean, we let the board happen, this graffiti board happen. During, you know, we have a gathering at night, and so people add to it then. And then the mornings, they add to it then. During a worship service, they add to it then. But then certain themes emerge on the board. And so I try to group those themes. Sometimes it'll have to do with clergy care. Other times it'll have to do with ordination processes. Other times it'll have to do with funding and resourcing new ministries. Other times it'll have to do with curriculum. And so then we begin to sort of form the organization around it. And then we put it into a chart, and it's a lot like Clue, like, you know, I'll take, you know, whatever, the candlestick in the library at 3 o'clock. But it's actually like, I'll take clergy care in the library at 3 o'clock or whatever. Yeah. And it's very scary for people who haven't been there. They get really nervous and worried, and a lot of times, you know, but we have enough people now who have gone and who have come back that pretty much in the room there's a feeling of, okay, we trust you, we trust that this will work. We've been doing it for about 6 years, And both, I'm not, I think it may be 4 years on the East Coast and the West Coast. So it's not like it's never been done before. You know, we do know how to do it.
Right. And so you're actually using some editorializing as it goes, right? I mean, you're putting the agenda together by grouping themes of what people have brought and giving a kind of an end product of here's the agenda that we're going to use. So the reason I ask this is like open space has been this buzzword for a while, right?
Yeah.
And it kind of talks about it as a panacea. Like if the church would only use open space more, all of its problems would go away. But I mean, there's actually people designated in that process to be making concrete decisions about what happens.
So we don't. What I will do is I'll group things together and suggest groupings, but the group itself will say, okay, you know, my project really doesn't go with that other project, you know, so they can say, no, that grouping doesn't work. I really want a separate time and a separate space. And so, mine are pretty much suggestions. What I create or what the host team creates is a skeleton. And so we have this skeleton, which is the schedule. It's the times and places where people meet. And then people will create the content that goes into it. And it's certainly no panacea to the whole church. As much as I love and respect Landon Whitsett, sorry, Landon. but definitely agree with his wonderful book. There are certain things that are difficult about it. For instance, we never have as much diversity as we want in the room, and that could be easily solved if we were able to say, okay, you know, five of our speakers are going to be people of color, and you know, we will pay them to come. And, you know, but we don't have that ability. It has been very diverse in many ways, but certainly not what we want. And, of course, that's always the constant struggle in a lot of our denominational settings. But it's something that we have to continually work on and something that grieves me a lot.
Yeah, the diversity piece in a Presbyterian church in the United States, it's a predominantly white institution, and you know, movements like UNCO and Next Church and things like this, diversity is at the top of the list of what they're trying to work on. But it often feels like, you know, there's only so much you can do. And whenever you try and say that you're trying to be diverse, there are certain people who will come, and that's the one thing they'll key on, and they will just blast you if it's not as diverse as they think it should be.
Right. I used to be a blaster, and I apologize, Rocky, because I think I've blasted Next Church when you've been involved before. So my apologies to everybody.
No apologies.
I know, we've all made mistakes.
Well, I think gatherings get better by taking critique.
Yeah.
You know, I think Next Church, and I want to talk about the relationship between UNCO and Next a little bit later, but I think Next has taken a posture of saying, you know, we're gonna embrace the critiques and try to incorporate them into what we're doing.
Right, and that's what we've tried to do as well, you know.
Yeah, so I want to ask you how you're doing that, particularly with the diversity piece. What are the strategies that you all are utilizing to try to create the kind of diverse gathering that you want?
Well, of course, certainly like getting people on board into leadership. We've always had a pretty diverse leadership, about 50%. We're working with gender, sexual orientation, and racial ethnic issues. So we've always had a lot of diversity when it comes to that. I shouldn't say racial ethnic issues. My apologies. I mean, racial ethnic people. We're all racial ethnic, but underrepresented racial ethnic people. So, we've always been extremely diverse in light of those three things, and a little bit with disability and differing abilities. And that's certainly a big topic of conversation in UNCO is differing abilities in the church. But, you know, racial, ethnic concerns and racial, ethnic representation is always the one that we seem to struggle with the most. So we just keep making sure that people are involved who are part of communities of color. And certainly there are, most of our ministers are progressive, most of them are working on social justice issues, and so it's very easy to do, but we just have to be very intentional about doing it.
Yeah, it's a, you know, what you have to account for, I would imagine, is that you're inviting people to come to a thing that's going to take 3 days. You're going to have to pay to travel to get there, and mm-hmm. Not everybody's going to be able to do that. What I wonder about the size of these gatherings. Like, how many people are typically at UNCO?
They're not big, so it wouldn't be anything like Next Church. We had one that was 75, I believe, and it was too big. So we like to range from about 35 to 50 is sort of the ideal range. So they seem bigger because we're bigger on the internet, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, wins Twitter.
Yeah, right. But no, it's actually just a pretty small group. Now, the other thing that happens is, okay, so there's 40 on East, 40 at West, and then people who go usually don't just, it's not like a conference. You know how you go to a conference and, like, these people are just amazing, and you think, wow, you're fantastic. I would love to get, you know, in touch with you, and so you, like, trade business cards, and you come home, and then you, like, look at this business card and think, who is that? what did we talk about, you know? So it's not that sort of gathering, because we are so very connected on Twitter or on Facebook, and so we're constantly working together. And so as it's become 6 years, we just keep growing and growing and growing in that way, because people may just come once, but they're still involved with the UNCO community pretty intensely.
Yeah. So do you cap the registrations?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. And like, you must be turning a lot of people away.
This year we haven't. We have in past years, yeah. But it's just the open space, that whole open space thing, it just doesn't work if it gets too big. You know, that is when you get too much chaos.
Yeah.
We've talked many times about, like, having other gatherings, and that's where we would like to grow instead of growing the particular conferences that we have. We'd like to grow in the Midwest or in the South, or, you know, that we've talked about that. And certainly other people have taken the unconference idea and they've spun off into different, and it's not our idea, you know, this is definitely something that came from a friend who is in the tech world, and, you know, she had been to Tech UNCOs, and so we kind of stole that idea. And so anyways, so if we grow, we would just like to grow in gatherings.
So not bigger gatherings, but more smaller ones.
Right, yeah.
Well, that's kind of a theme that comes up a lot in conversations about, you know, church transformation, is that the fixation with the size of the gathering, whether it's a congregation or a conference or whatever, is counterproductive, and that you can actually do a lot more substantive community building and discipleship and things like that with a smaller group of people.
Yeah, you know, I just preached at an African American church yesterday, Renaissance Presbyterian Church, and I work with this church a lot. And they are so amazing. They are totally in tune with the neighborhood. They're working. They're giving out Christmas gifts. They're mentoring children. They have this incredible tutoring that's going on. They've got incredible summer programs. They put out more work probably on a yearly average than most 1,000 member churches. And yet they're just this small handful of people. And you know, I don't know what to do about that because they can't afford a pastor. And that's why I can't, you know, that's why I come in and preach. But at the same time, I do think the size allows them to be a lot more responsive to the community than a larger church could be in some ways. You know, there's pluses and minuses to both, right?
Yeah. One of the things that I'm thinking a lot about is with projects like this, and this podcast is just an opportunity for me to talk to people who are working on projects that interest me, is that the projects that seem to really thrive and really get off the ground and do, you know, important work and make an impact mm-hmm. have like a person or two or at the most three who really own the idea and who are really doing all of the work to get it going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not a big collective, collaborative community, right? In the leadership question, I wonder how that feels to you with your experience in UNCO about the size of the group of leaders and your own role as a leader. I mean, this is important to you. It's your project. You have the most at stake in its outcome. And so it makes sense to me that the circle of people who you want taking charge of it might be smaller.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And this is the place where we're having some growing pains in the sense of we are going to have some sort of organizational structure. And we've been kind of this gathering of friends who have been meeting and dreaming for all of these years. And we've seen this unbelievable amount of communities that come out of UNCO, that have been a part of UNCO, that have been sustained and nurtured by UNCO. And then at the same time, you know, we've had this amorphous structure, but we also want to start doing ebook publishing. We want to start having more intentional pastoral care for people. And we also want to start fundraising, raising money for UNCO participants and people who have new church developments that have come out of UNCO. And so you can't do all of that with volunteers. And so we're trying to figure out, you know, a more sustainable structure. And plus, you know, people have reflected that it's hard to get in. And that's another like downfall with open source groups is like it's kind of like, well, everybody's welcome and everybody in leaderships thinks that they're super open and everything. But when you don't have a nominating committee and you don't have the structure of people, you know, this board that meets, then it's hard for people to know where to knock, you know?
Yeah. And well, your website says you have a board.
Yes. So we formed a board this year. And so we're nonprofit, or we've gotten to the first steps of becoming a nonprofit organization. And so, you know, all of that is, you know, and we're having to grow up a little bit, and, which is really, really exciting and interesting. But it's all, you know, there's some people who are like, well, wait, remember when we were just, you know, just hanging out together and having fun and dreaming? So there's all those tensions involved, which is wonderful and exciting. But it's when a movement kind of turns into an organization, that's what happens.
Yeah. So you're only 6 years old, and yet nostalgia is already something you're having to contend with.
Absolutely, yes, yes. You know, we developed nostalgia for last week. yep, it still happens.
So UNCO is trying to become a 501c3 nonprofit organization, yeah?
Right, right. Yeah, we have to do it. And, you know, it's just if we want to keep moving forward, we're going to have to keep moving forward.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to hear that. I think that this aspect of building new organizations within the church to do ministry is one that there's not a lot of, I don't think there's a ton of expertise in the Presbyterian Church about how to do that. And so people who do it should take careful notes and teach the rest of us what they're learning.
And the interesting thing about it that I didn't realize about UNCO, and I don't mean to sound like immodest, although that's the point of this, right? Okay. So one of the things that I learned is that I work with the Center for Progressive Renewal, and they did this big study on new church developments, and they worked with the UCC, the DOC, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, almost every denomination that's, you know, kind of progressive denomination other than the UMC, the Methodist Church. So they did a study of the churches that have been started in the last 10 years. And we found that there were only like a couple of hundred of them. I mean, there just aren't a lot. And I also write a column for the Christian Century called Church in the Making, where I try to highlight new church movements and things that are happening in church and new worshiping communities. And, you know, kind of between those, I realized that UNCO has like 20% of new churches and new church developments sort of represented. So, and, you know, I may be, that statistic may be totally off, but, you know, it's a pretty high percentage from what I can tell, what I can gather. Yeah. So to have that many practitioners in one place or two places is pretty stunning. And the amount of like real discussion and real work and real excitement and real frustration that comes out of having these people together. And, you know, like I said, they're not usually the big name people. They're just kind of scrappers who are trying to figure out how to get insurance next month. And, you know, yeah, to have that group of people together is just, I think that's what makes it so interesting.
Yeah. You use the term practitioners, which I think, I think that's really significant. My image of UNCO is, I don't know if it's, a lot of people have this image who've never been to it, but have followed it on Twitter and have read your writing about it, is that it's a gathering that aims at, you know, being kind of a community and a space for belonging for a diverse group of people. But what you're describing actually sounds more like, you know, working groups that are trying to get things done and start new projects.
Right. So I kind of alluded to this before, but day one, we have this graffiti board where we just kind of throw up everything that we bring to the conference, frustrations and excitement and dreams. And day two, we have discussions, and like I said, they're, you know, breakout groups along project lines, you know. But then day three, we talk about what has legs, or, you know, what sort of projects we want to continue working on throughout the year or throughout the next 5 years, as has been the case for some of these projects. But in day three, you know, I don't want to take too much like credit for some of these things, but there have been a significant number of people who have said, you know, well, I was dreaming about this church for 7 years, and then I went to UNCO and realized, wait a second, I can do this, you know, because you're just surrounded by people who have done it. You're totally surrounded by people who are giving you permission to do it, and you're surrounded by people who will support you in doing it. And so, so like I said, I don't want to take too much credit for spinning off these churches, but it's really kind of stunning the number of people who have started churches, you know, after being a part of UNCO, or, you know, or the UNCO's been supportive in that process of starting new churches, of starting new ministries, of starting new things within their traditional churches. But yeah, it's very much practice oriented. It's very much social justice oriented, acting oriented.
Yeah. Well, and you could take as much credit for that as you want. I mean,
you know, it's the people on the ground who are really doing it. But you know, it's just exciting to be involved.
Right. But you've taken ownership to actually put the space together and to do the planning and to invite people, and you've put some things on the line to actually make that happen. And so I think some credit is probably due. The question of ownership is something that I keep thinking about. Like, who owns these projects? UNCO is not, you know, formally a sponsor of these things, but you do want to take credit that the idea for the Garden Church, for example, which is one of the projects on your website, mm-hmm. was birthed at UNCO. So when you decide that a project has legs on that third day, whose job is it then to kind of move it to the next step or take action on it? Do you do that? Does UNCO have some structure of people who are helping those projects, or is it just up to the people who were at the gathering who wanted to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I want to make sure I go back and say, I don't do like the most of the legwork.
There's a team.
I mean, Deb Avery has been doing West for the last couple of years. Shannon Meacham has been doing East so I'd be in like big trouble if I said, you know, oh yes, I do it all. Yeah. And there's a host team of people who are involved with making sure that all of the registrations come in and all of the things happen. And then there's, you know, kind of this board that's in charge of FundCo, which may not be FundCo, FUNDCO. That may not be the like final name for it, but right, you know, we do everything.
We're a fundamentalist conference.
Right. That would be scary, huh? But no, there it's funding sources. We're thinking about funding sources for new churches, or you know, or there's spaces like, you know, the ebook publishing, which we're calling Unshelved right now.
Yeah.
So, or there is pastoral care elements. So these are all things that are led by people who work much harder than I do. So I don't want to.
I didn't mean to heap all that on you.
Yeah, no, I've just kind of been there the longest.
Sure. By the way, you know there is a Presbyterian minister who started an ebook outfit a few years ago called Shook Foil Books, right?
Yes, yeah, and great. You know, I've read some of Bruce Reyes Chow.
Oh, right.
Published a book on there. So yeah, it's just been amazing.
My favorite thing that they've published is a little memoir called A Bucket Full of Hooves by a guy named Jeff Bryan, who I was in seminary with, who I plug that book whenever I can because he's a great writer.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So, what was your original question?
I was interested in what happens with the projects that have legs. Do the people who feel a sense of ownership for them take it on, or is there some other structure to move them forward?
So let's take Anna Wolfenden, who started the Garden Church. She's an amazing person, and she started this church right out of seminary. And basically what happened with Anna was she had a calling to to start a new church and to be a part of a new church movement. She wanted to be part of a movement of starting new churches. And that was a calling that she had for years, even before, you know, going to UNCO. So I was friends with Anna, and she worked as my booking manager for a while. And she went to UNCO, and I think it was there where she, like, stopped calling herself a seminary student and started calling herself a church planter. And even when she was a senior in seminary, she began to gather her group together. So she began to gather a network of support, people who would pray for her, people who committed to this organization financially, spiritually. She gathered her board together, and so, you know, so I think maybe UNCO was able to nudge her a little bit. And yeah. But certainly, you know, the impetus has been on Anna and has been on, you know, she's been doing most of the work. Certainly people who are part of UNCO are part of that board and part of that support system for her and give money, you know, to help her. So that's sort of how it works. It'll depend on the person who is who wants to start the new project. There have been other projects like Liturgy Link. Do you know about Liturgy Link?
I don't know about Liturgy Link.
That was one of the first projects that came out of UNCO. It's like the one of the very beginning, and this was this wonderful project that a group of Presbyterians started, and they wanted to have more of an open source idea of liturgy. And so, and it ended up kind of being like a blog that people could contribute to, and they could also, you know, kind of change the wordings and share things with. So,
they were creating liturgies online.
Right. And you know, this was 6 years ago, so that was a new thing, right? So that was kind of big.
Technology timeline, that's ages ago, right?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it was just this wonderful sort of thing that came out of it. So sometimes they're little projects. Sometimes, you know, people will go, wow, I can start a garden in my church. And we have lots of discussions about how to build a rain barrel or where's the best place to get plants or, you know, these very elementary practical things that you need to know.
I love yeah. the practical, skill-based stuff.
Right.
The garden church is in California. What part of California?
It is, I always get this wrong. It's near Los Angeles.
Okay, so it's close to me then, so I got to go check this out.
Yeah, you do. She is fantastic, so you'll love it.
All right, cool. The piece about that I think is significant is that individuals have to own the project. Nobody's gonna do it for you, and you're getting a group of people together who all are coming to the event with something that they want to explore in a community of other people who are exploring the same thing. So,
right, here, and there are wonderful like traditional church pastors who are like, you know, I'm just interested in what's new, what's going on. There are stated clerks or execs who will come because they want to know. That's Presby speak, in case some of you aren't Presbyterian. But they just want to know, like, what's new in the church right now, and they want to know how to support it. And, of course, we need traditional churches. We need new churches. We all need to be working in this together. So that's the beautiful thing about it.
Thanks for listening to the Yo Rocco podcast, my weekly conversation with leaders about their interesting projects. This week we talked to Carol Howard Merritt. Carol is getting ready to lead UNCO, the UNConference, next week at the Stony Point Conference Center in New York. But in addition to her involvement with UNCO, she's a writer and she is about to begin a journey with a new worshiping community, which she talked quite a bit about in the second half of this conversation. So I hope that you are enjoying the conversation so far. Here's the second half of my time with Carol Howard Merritt. Thanks for listening.
Well, let me turn to you for a little while. Where does UNCO fit in your sort of portfolio of things that you're working on? You do work with the Center for Progressive Renewal. You run the Christian Century. You've written a couple of books. Where does this project fit in the constellation of all those other things?
Well, it feels like I kind of have two callings, which is kind of interesting. I have this one calling to kind of church redevelopment, church renewal. I'm starting a worshiping community. My husband's starting a worshiping community.
You are?
Yes. Yeah.
Your husband are not doing the same one. It's two separate ones?
It's two separate ones. I don't know what the presbytery is going
to
think about that. I just,
said separate podcast. Anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead. You were saying two separate calls.
Right. So what happened was there's a group of women who were formerly incarcerated, and they were formerly incarcerated in Georgia, and they became sisters in a lot of ways. You know, they were incarcerated for 10 years, and they really supported one another, and so they worked together, and they also found incredible hope from a woman named Kelly Gissendanner. And Kelly Gissendanner was somebody who was on death row. And she's been incarcerated for 18 years. And during that 18 years, she has just done incredible things. She got a certificate of theology. People at Emory, theologians would go to her cell and teach her classes. I can't say enough about the seminaries in Georgia and how much they have done for women in prison. And you know, people like Barbara Brown Taylor have taught her. She's pen pals with Yoram Moltmann. And not only that, but she's been this incredible source of light and hope for women in prison. And she would pray for women, and she would always whisper encouragement and always tell women that they were loved and that God loved them and that people loved them. And so she, you know, Kelly formed a sisterhood around her. And many of the women have gotten out, and they began to advocate for Kelly, who was incarcerated, and she was heading toward death row. And some of you know the story. It's been in the New York Times. It's been kind of all over the place. But her execution has been put off twice, and they're still struggling for Kelly. But also their advocacy has grown towards other things as well. And they wanted to start a worshiping community. And so they asked me to be their pastor. And it'll be, you know, we'll have services inside and outside of the prison walls and build the community. It's a non-geographic community. So we'll live stream our services
How did they know you to ask you to do this?
Well, I was just friends with them. A lot of them were involved with Mercy Junction, which is the community that my husband started. And Kara, one of the women, works for Mercy Junction. So,
did it surprise you that they wanted to start a worshiping community? Did you see that coming?
No, not at all. But I was super excited, you know, and it's been really fun, like, dreaming about it and thinking about it. So,
interesting. It reminds me, I don't know if you've heard Aaron Dunnigan's story about living in Baja, Mexico, with this community of expats and sort of atheists who got to know her and then asked her to be a pastor to them in their little community.
I've heard like bits and pieces of that story. It's fascinating.
It's a similar kind of story of an existing network of relationships issuing in some kind of a call to someone to be a pastoral leader in that community.
Right.
It's
yeah.
Totally different from how our call system in a structured church works.
Right. Well, a lot of it's really like difficult to figure out because our presbyteries are geographic, so they're organized, you know, geographically, but you know, it doesn't, the world doesn't work that any way anymore. So the Struggle Sisters are both in Georgia and in Tennessee, and they go across these geographic bounds. So it's interesting because, you know, they'll be using Skype and live streaming and that sort of thing. But our church structures haven't really, you know, we don't know how to deal with that in a lot of ways.
Yeah, the Struggle Sisters.
Yes, Struggle Sisters. That's the network. And you know, I don't know if we'll call the worshiping community Struggle Sisters, but certainly they are the heart of the community. But they you know, they want to be open to men, and so, you know, and to anybody who'd be invited, you know, who would want to join with us.
So where are you in the process of forming a worshiping community?
I just sent a letter off to our new church development committee in the presbytery.
Which presbytery?
So, Presbytery of East Tennessee.
Tennessee, okay.
Yeah, so, you know, who knows what's going to happen. They may just look at it and say, wait, we're already giving your husband money. Why do we want two merits on the payroll? I don't know. We'll see. But they feel a sense and a calling that's different and separate from Mercy Junction. So
I didn't know anything about that. I'm glad you told me about that.
Yeah. So that's sort of, you know, I've got this one side of me who's working with new church developments. I'm writing about new church developments for Christian Century, doing UNCO. Speaking and doing a lot of things with Center for Progressive Renewal, coaching pastors and consulting. And so that's sort of my church world. And then I'm writing a book for Harper One on how people are abused and also healed by the spiritual life. And so I'm finishing that up right now. So that's very painful.
Where did that come from?
Probably from my past experiences. You know, I've got the story that's become very common now, right? It's I grew up as a fundamentalist Southern Baptist, went to a Bible school, was saved by the Presbyterians, but, you know, just was frustrated with the sexism and homophobia and racism that was so inherent in where I was. But, you know, Rocky, you're on Twitter, you're on Facebook. You hear, like, people are just in pain in a lot of these circles and in a lot of spaces in which I have worked. People have a lot of this, like, kind of visceral pain. In fact, they'll put on their tweets, you know, trigger warning, I'm going to talk about, you know, or there's a lot of books coming out about PTSD, church PTSD. And
I react to a lot of that stuff in, like, the least pastoral way possible. It's like, you know.
Really? Do you get irritated by it?
Irritated. It just kind of freaks me out. Like, it's, you know, if it's on Twitter, it's sort of like, that's more than I can handle on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, anyways, maybe that's why I'm writing a book on it instead of just tweeting about it. but you know, my own experience was, you know, we had a pastor who was a pedophile, and then just working in the church, I'm constantly working with people who have had these very wounding experiences, And so over the years, I've developed, you know, ways of healing, as we all have. You know, how do we heal from these spiritual wounds? How do we go from just, you know, just complaining about it on Twitter, which is very important and very necessary, but how can we move from that to a place of healing and a place, and you know, the complaining's part of the healing process, but you know, how do we move on, or how do we come to some sort of peace with ourselves and with God and our neighbor?
Right, with spirituality as a resource, right?
I mean, right.
The impulse, oftentimes, I would imagine, is to just get away from that entirely.
Yeah, and that works for some people, but for some reason, for others, it just doesn't work. I mean, a friend of mine, Frank Schaefer, a lot of you might know him from he had a famous dad named Frank Schaefer. He was Frankie Schaefer for a while, evangelical, but he talks about, like, if I ever tried to leave Christianity, the first thing I would do is pray about how I could do this. and that's kind of where I was, you know, even though I had a very difficult, kind of tragic and wounding experience in a lot of ways growing up, I also had this orientation towards religion that just wouldn't allow me to leave, and I just won't be able to, I don't think. So then, how do I do that? How do you do that?
Yeah, so that's the book you're working on.
Right, yeah. Which I need to get much more succinct in explaining that. So thanks for trying it out on me, Rocky.
Well, if the podcast still exists when the book comes out, I'll talk to you again about it.
Okay, great.
Well, you left an installed associate pastor call about 4 or 5 years ago in the D.C. area. Is that right?
Right, yeah.
But you've had this length of time to not be in an installed church position, but to be doing the writing and the coaching and the UNCO stuff. Does it just feel to you like your vocation or your life is totally different than it was then, or does it still feel like continuous, like it's the same work?
You know what? I guess it's been 3 years. Gotta say it's 3 years. And during that time, I was an interim. So, in a lot of ways, yes, and it's been a lot of grieving because I didn't leave the pastorate. I was a solo pastor for 7 years before going to D.C., and I didn't leave the pastorate, you know, like I read Barbara Brown Taylor's Leaving Church and kind of thought, well, you know, that's not really my story. I thought I would have this great resonance with her, but I didn't leave the pastorate because I didn't want to be a pastor. It was just that, you know, Brian had this opportunity, and he had followed me to 3 pastorate jobs, and so I really needed to follow him. And then once I got here, there weren't a lot of opportunities for me. So there was a lot of grieving involved, and there was a lot of, there still is, you know, especially in identity. You know, when you tell people you're a writer, people don't really believe me, you know. Like, what I remember, I was talking to this seminary student, and I said something about, like, oh, I blogged about that, and he rolled his eyes.
Oh, no.
And I was like, yeah, and I was like, no, like, I'm a real blogger.
I don't have a Blogspot address. I actually bought the domain.
I mean, yeah, like, everybody's a real blogger, but you know what I mean? I always feel like I'm in this constant struggle of, like, no, really, I matter, I'm important. But because people don't, like, you know, whatever. And so I'm, like, known as Brian's wife everywhere here. So that's really hard. I'm grieving it a lot.
It's funny because that might be locally how you're known, but I mean, you have a national audience that many of whom don't even know who Brian is.
Yeah, yeah. So, but then, you know, you can't really say that. Like, I really do have an identity outside of my husband. Yeah. So, but anyways. So that's new to me, because I've always been a pastor, you know, on top of whatever I'm doing. And so that's new, that's hard. But the good thing, and you know, I miss preaching, I love preaching, I miss doing it, I miss being a pastor. But there is a sense of kind of that hectic thing of juggling. I mean, I was juggling pastoring and writing and speaking for about 6 years, seven years, and it's hard. Like, it's really hard. Like, because sometimes you know you're like trying to figure out how to speak and not take away from your calling as a pastor, and then you're trying to figure out how to pastor and not shortchange the people that you're presenting to.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I'm a mom, and so, you know, I always felt like I was half-assing it somewhere. You know, there was always some ball I was dropping at some time. And or, you know, but now it's like I'm fully there when I'm at a conference. I'm fully there when I'm at home. I'm fully so it feels a lot more, I feel a lot more healthy.
Yeah.
And so yeah, and a lot of it's just been kind of like letting go of my ego of like not having everything. You know, and that, I guess it's all, you know, growing up, just realizing, okay, just because you can do it doesn't mean that you have to do it. So that's where I've been, even though I'm sad and I miss it, but there's this
new thing that's emerging that is going to put you in a very different kind of pastoral role, but a pastoral role all the same.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see what happens, what becomes of it.
That's emerged out of just organic relationships where you are, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, every once in a while they'll say, wait, but you're also a writer too, right? I'm like, yes, I am. Yeah. But yeah, so and every once in a while, like, I'll have to tell them, okay, well, you know, this is about the time when my book will come out and I'll need to be on the road again. So it's sort of a like I'll have a book that comes out and then I get a lot of speaking, you know, based on that book, and then it kind of ebbs and flows. So right now I don't have as many speaking engagements right now. So, and who knows, you know, the next book may come out and I may not get any after that. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But what's been happening so far is I'll have a book comes out and then I'll have speaking engagements, and then it kind of trickles off because, you know, everybody's heard what I had to say. And then it starts up again. So I'm always trying to explain to them. So yeah. this happens, and it might happen in a year. Sure. So
I don't know if you like Seth Godin and these kind of people who write and blog about just the nature of creative work in this day and age. A lot of the people that I talk to on this podcast, you know, have projects that are in addition to their jobs. Like, for example, the reason I'm talking to you is because Eric Clark really, really was on my podcast about 2 months ago and was really high on Unco and said I should talk to you about Unco. And so I said, that makes perfect sense. But Eric has this video project called Lection Eric that is not paying him anything, but he's really passionate about it and he's creating really great stuff.
Right.
And yet he goes and tells people that he has a video, you know, YouTube channel, and they would probably roll their eyes like that seminarian roll. as a blogger. But, I mean, who cares?
Yeah, that, right.
It matters to you, and you're actually contributing stuff to the world that you may not see the effect of it right now in terms of a job title or income.
Right,
But, you know, you probably get this all the time, and I don't, I've never written a book. Your audience is a lot bigger than mine, but still, even with just a little blog, I hear from people months after I put something on a blog post, and they say they remembered it, and I don't even remember it. Like, you're creating content, you're owning it, and you're owning the responsibility to put it out there and take the risk and put your name on it, and in Seth Godin's term, ship it. And that's a courageous thing, and I don't think any of us would want to just go through life not doing that, like, because we're in some protective little role that keeps us from having to do that.
Yeah, and, you know, and I just want to thank you, Rocky, for doing the podcast, because I know, like, what a big, it's fun, and it's exciting and everything, but it's also difficult. It's time-consuming.
That sensation of feeling like you're dropping a ball everywhere. I felt that a lot. No, seriously.
Yes. So, and I guess the other side is true. Like, and I don't mean to, like, be whiny or cry, blah blah blah. But sometimes people have the sense that, you know, well, you write a popular blog, or you do a great podcast, or you do. I have a lot of friends who do these amazing, or even, you know, you write a book, and a lot of people, I don't think, understand how little you get from that. And so I just think people can be extraordinarily mean with critiques when, you know, I always feel like saying, wait a second, don't give her 2 stars on Goodreads. Give her a break. She wrote a book. You know, she got nothing out of it. And you're going to sit on your butt and critique her. You just, like, give her some stars because she finished it, you know? So there is a little bit about, like, people are extraordinarily critical. That's one thing about our creative life today that I don't appreciate, and I think we need to be much kinder to our artists.
Isn't it a rule when you read a book or when you write a book to never read the Amazon comments?
Yeah, definitely.
You read them, don't you?
Well, I did Amazon because that was kind of before everybody figured out that rule. And then there's this, like, Barnes & Noble came up, and I think I've got, like, 2 1-star reviews on Barnes & Noble because I just got on there. And they're, like, the most ridiculous reviews ever. Yeah. So,
respond to them?
No.
Well, that would be a tragic mistake.
Yeah, no, I mean, you just don't look. So, but I am to the point where, like, I'll read comments on my blog, but if I blog for Huffington Post or Red Letter Christian or places that have a little bigger audience, I don't read them. Or if something, you know, if there are some people on my blog that are just making no logical sense, you know, I quit reading them. There is a sense where you really have to protect yourself and protect your creativity and protect your art and, you know, just because we're not made to sustain all that.
Yeah, and I'm making a connection to the size of Unco and the size of an audience for a book. Mm-hmm. I think you must expect when it's published by somebody like Harper's that, I mean, there are certain sales numbers they want, the audience needs to be a certain size, but in reality, if you imagine that you're creating something valuable for a small community of people who really care about it and who it's really going to help, doesn't that change how you think about what you're doing?
Oh, definitely. Like, so, yeah, Unco is intentionally small. But then when you're, when, you know, when you think about with Harper One, you know, one of the first things that I had to do when I was hiring an agent was figure, they wanted to know about my platform, so they want to know about all the Facebook numbers and all the Twitter numbers and how many people read my blog and how many people, how many conferences I speak at. And then, you know, and then they're going to, like, you know, and they'll tell you kind of in the back, in the background, all of us have had the experience who have gone to seminary. We pick up a Bart Ehrman book and you're like, wait a second, this isn't exciting new knowledge. This is like seminary 101, right? But they bring it to the public like, wow, this is extraordinarily new academic research, and it's going to change the whole way you view Jesus. Right. And they know that they're doing that. You know, they just also know how to sell things, right? And so they know that people in the pews have not had that experience of going to seminary and have their entire world rocked because they're now looking at Jesus completely differently because of what they've learned in seminary. So they're going to sell it in that way. And so, yeah, there is a definite different marketing techniques. There's different ways in which you view what you do. There's a different way in which you present yourself. You know, obviously at UNCO among 50 people, I can be very, very much myself when I'm, you know, in bigger venues. I need more private space, and so, you know, a lot of us are pastors maybe who are listening to this, so we know how to negotiate that, and you just kind of end up doing that. You know, you're one person around four or five different people and kind of a different person around the church, not because you are a different person or because you're being a hypocrite or, you know, wearing a mask or anything, but just because you have to have different energy. And it's kind of the same way with marketing things.
Interesting. Yeah, these conferences and gatherings now have this sensitivity toward the introverts that I notice every time. And the feedback,
right,
surveys, the evaluations, there's always the introvert complaint about there was too much group time. I didn't have enough time on my own. And I always want to say, well, then leave.
I know, me too. I'm like, just be an adult and walk out. Nobody's like forcing you to be there.
Yeah. Let me ask you just one quick thing about, you said you don't get that much out of writing a book. Why is that? I mean, you mean in terms of income?
Oh, yeah, in terms of income. You know.
Or what?
What's that?
Because the publisher takes most of it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my books have done pretty well, but, you know, both of them have been pretty niche books that are used in seminary a lot. So they've sold several thousand, but, you know, when you think about over the years how much income that is, it's not like I would be able to quit everything else and just write. It's certainly the move to Harper's a different sort of move, so there's they just sell more books because they're one of the, is it the Big Six or the Big Seven publishing?
I don't know.
Yeah, whatever. It changes because publishing's changing so much, but I think it's, you know, part of the Big Six. So so that's a different sort of level. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people think that what you get out of it is you get this incredibly life-giving process of, you know, just working really hard on something, researching something, learning about yourself and learning about your subject matter, of being able to reach people that you didn't know that you had anything in common with. So you get this incredible life-giving relationship with the book, with yourself, with your audience, and And so that's what you get out of it, usually, for most of us who are writing. And then, you know, sometimes we get lucky and get some money, too.
But the choice to embrace writing as a vocational path is not one thing. It's many things. I mean, you write in, you have your own blog, you write for the Christian Century, you're writing books. You also have to speak to support those books and that writing. I mean, it sounds like the choice to embrace that vocationally means taking on a really kind of fragmented way of working on multiple things at the same time.
Yeah, and you know, I used to have this like really kind of romanticized idea about, like, for instance, Lauren Winter. She became a New York Times bestseller before there were blogs and podcasts and Twitter and Facebook. And I don't even know if she is on Facebook and Twitter, but so I always thought, man, how cool it would be. You would hear about these writers who were hermits and they locked themselves up and it was just, you know, them and the book, and I was like, man, I have to work so hard blogging and Twittering, and like that's when I'm feeling sorry for myself, because usually that's just fun and procrastination. But you know, some, like, especially when I'm filling out these numbers for publishers who want to know how many Facebook friends I have, and it just seems so ridiculous, you know. Like I'm like, Calvin didn't have to deal with this, right? But then I realize, you know, well, it's also fun for me. I mean, you know, I'm excited that there are times when I just have a ridiculous idea in my head and I want to get it out in 5 minutes, and I can write a blog about it and, you know, thousands of people will read it.
Yeah.
So that's also kind of cool, you know, when I don't get, and also, you know, Lauren Winter's now editing my book, so obviously she's,
oh, really?
she has writer workshops, and she's excellent, you know, she's just amazing, but, you know, she's not just writing in a cave somewhere either, so you kind of learn.
And the person today who probably is the biggest source of that myth for people is like Rachel Held Evans, right?
Yeah.
Huge, yeah.
But she's kind of on, you know, she's a blogger. She's constantly talking with people, and she really interacts with people. She works hard.
I mean, it's another example, I think, of that. The writing is not just one thing. You've got to be doing lots of different things to support that and to build an audience and to actually create relationships with people around the work that you're doing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it's a beautiful thing. It's something I really, really enjoy and am passionate about and love doing, you know, aside from having to fill out stupid numbers forms.
Well, it's a total world away from Frederick Buechner's memoirs about being ordained to be a writer. I don't know if you read Buechner's memoirs.
But I have, yes.
He talked about just sitting up in the room in his house and just trying to fill the time and feeling like a fraud. And, you know, for him, it really was that isolated, lonely pursuit. I mean, there was no Facebook. There was no Twitter. But it's very, very different now. He was not out there hustling to try to build an audience online. Those tools didn't exist, but the fundamental challenge of the work, the courage it takes to do the work, to put an idea out there and put your name on it, is still the same.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's like energy level for me that I imagine is different. I mean, I've never lived in that world where I wasn't hustling in some way. But for me, it's that energy level is different in the sense of criticism and also the sense of interaction and compliments or feedback. So, you know, when you spend time working on a book, you know, right now I'm in the midst of rewriting and I'm scared to death, I'm worried, I'm concerned, and, you know, I think I'm an idiot, I don't know who I think I am, and, you know, I have all this self-doubt and stuff. And then when you blog about something, you kind of have immediate response, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but you have this, like, immediate reaction, and I think that's why I like doing both, but the energy level for one kind of sustains me for the other, and you know, and then there's sometimes when I don't need all that energy, and I'd rather not have it, and then that's when I kind of get buried in my book. But yeah, I'm an introvert, but you know, we all get some sort of energy from reactions from people, from conversation and being in community.
Well, I appreciate the work that you're doing. I want to ask you one more question about UNCO, and then I'll let you go. You've been very generous with your time. You said that people bring issues, you put it on the big board. The website for UNCO encourages people to be thinking about what they want to discuss and get into when they get there. So is there something that you are going to put on the board at UNCO next week?
Now, I've been putting the same things on the board, I think, for the last 3 years, and that is, for me, it's the wounding and healing, you know, my book topic. I very much hash that out at UNCO and get people's advice and research on that. The e-publishing, which is almost embarrassing because, you know, I feel like, oh, you know, things happen slower than you hope, so that, you know, we'll definitely all bring to it. And the other thing would be the funding sources. I'm very passionate about how do we fund new churches. A lot of people, especially who are working with people who are maybe on the a different socioeconomic level, or are homeless or formerly incarcerated, or, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people who are working with people who can't fund churches in the traditional sense, in the traditional way. So I'm very, very passionate about, like, how do we figure this out? How do we start funding churches that are doing almost missionary work within our own country, or doing work that's vital and important but cannot be sustained in the traditional model. Yeah. So those are the three things, the three areas that I've been putting on the board for the past 3 years, and we'll probably go on the board again. Just sometimes these are long-term problems or long-term projects. Yeah. Well, definitely I'll be wanting some help on how to move forward with Struggle Sisters and how to get it off the ground.
Well, I will be watching with interest the Twitter feed and the things that you write about UNCO when it's over. Good luck. Have a great
Thank
time.
Thank you. And we would love to see you there sometime.
Well, I would love to go to the one up in San Anselmo. That's maybe a day's drive from where I am.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and is Eric going to go to that one since he's out on this coast now?
Probably. That's what he did last year, so I'm hoping so.
That would be a selling point for me. So.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and for all the work that you're doing. I look forward to seeing what comes next.
Thank you, Rocky, and thanks again for doing the podcast.
Oh, I'm loving it. Thanks for being part of it.
I enjoy it very much. Listen to it regularly.
Great. Thanks, Carol.
Bye.
Thanks again to Carol Howard Merritt for her generous time this week in the conversation. Good luck, Carol, and everybody at UNCO next week. You should follow the Twitter hashtag for UNCO. It's hashtag UNCO15, starting on Monday to see what they're up to and what they're doing. Thanks as well, as always, to Landon Whitsitt, a.k.a. Go to Sleep John Darling, for the theme music that he composed and performed for the podcast. And also, as always, thanks to Brian Ellison for that terrific little radio-quality introduction at the beginning of the podcast. As always, you can listen to every episode we've done of this so far at YoRocco.com. Click the Yo Rocco podcast tab link at the top, and all 12 episodes of the podcast are there for you to listen to live streaming on the internet. Thanks as always. You can email me with questions or thoughts, RockyCPC at gmail.com. And so until next time, have a good day. Bye.